Hello everyone and welcome to the Small World Big Problems podcast, the security and strategy podcast of the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins SAIS. I am your host Kritika Narayanan and today we are looking at democracy and how changes within democratic systems are reshaping the international order. Around the world, democratic erosion is influencing alliances, power dynamics, and the rules that govern global cooperation. These developments are not just domestic, and they carry real implications for security, diplomacy, as well as global stability. To help us unpack what's happening and why it matters, I am joined by Professor Michael Coppedge, who is the co-founder and principal investigator of the Varieties of Democracy Project, VDEM, one of the leading global efforts to track and analyze democratic change. Professor Coppedge, welcome. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to start by asking you about the current global wave of democratic backsliding. This is also highlighted in VDEM's latest report, which states that nearly 50% of the world's population is currently living under some form of autocratic system. Do you think that this is a temporary regression, or do you think that this global wave of democratic backsliding signals a more durable transformation in the global order?
Well, in part, I think that the autocratization that's been going on in the world shouldn't be that surprising, because the second part of the third wave of democracy, which occurred after the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1989, brought transitions to democracy in a lot of countries around the world. It was the biggest positive wave there has ever been. And it occurred in a lot of countries that were poor or divided or had weak states. And I think we got our hopes up too much to expect that democracy would last in all of these countries. And so I think a lot of what we've been seeing lately is kind of a regression to the mean, a return to a more sustainable set of democracies around the world. This autocratization trend is real. And increasingly, it follows a path that is more of an erosion of democracy, in which elected leaders lead a concentration of power and a diminution of rights, and a slide into a less democratic regime or even a non-democratic regime. That doesn't mean that there are no military coups anymore. They still happen from time to time in some countries. We've especially seen a few in West Africa. But I think that we have to remember that all of this backsliding is taking place in a minority of countries around the world. It's true that there are now, at least in our last report, three times as many countries autocratized as the number that democratized. But still, the total number of countries that were changing in one direction or another is a few dozen countries out of nearly 200 countries in the world. The great majority of countries in the world have not changed. And so this is a phenomenon that's confined to a minority of the countries in the world. It's also worrisome that many of them happen to be very large countries, especially India. But still, most countries don't change their democracy score most of the time, and the majority did not change in the past 10 years. And some countries have even become more democratic during this time. So what does that mean for the global balance of power, living in a somewhat more autocratic world? I think that, there is some cooperation among autocratic states that goes along. I think a lot of this is happening between the states that are heavily sanctioned, like Venezuela or Iran. And the heavily sanctioned states have strengthened their ties with Russia, another autocratic regime. I think there's also much greater influence by China recently. It's not so much anti-democratic influence. It's mostly investment and trade finance kinds of influence. And everybody is trading a lot with China. But I think there are very few countries that really feel like they have a common cause with China, that they have a shared political agenda. In fact, there are more countries that are resisting China's political influence. The U.S. position has weakened internationally, especially in the past year, very, very dramatically. But I consider this, to use soccer terminology, an own goal. The United States and the Trump administration is undermining its own soft power by dismantling USAID and dramatically cutting back on development funding and questioning its cooperation with NATO countries, and just a whole lot of ways. The United States is not seeking to promote democracy around the world these days, and it's also setting a bad example. But on the bright side, I think that European nations have become more united, knowing that they cannot count on the United States to be allied with them in every circumstance.
Building on that, Professor, how should policymakers and analysts use disaggregated democracy data more effectively to understand democratic erosion before it becomes irreversible?
So I would just encourage people to look at how the numeric scores are changing. Is it a large change or a small change? And especially to pay attention to what specific areas of democracy have been changing. What are the components that have changed a lot? Because we provide really disaggregated data, not only summary indices of five different kinds of democracy, but also really specific indicators about the quality of elections, about activities in civil society, about how the legal system is working, how party competition has changed, about state strength, about sovereignty. Just we have and that yields a lot more information about what's going on than just looking at which category a country ends up in. And often, a change from one category to another can be just a very small change. And sometimes there are large changes that don't result in a change of category. So I think there's a lot more information contained in the numeric indicators than that.
Cooperation among autocratic regimes is often ad hoc rather than deeply institutionalized, yet still consequential in areas like sanctions evasion and information warfare. To what extent should we think of this as a coordinated authoritarian international effort? And where do democracies tend to overestimate or underestimate this threat?
I think there is some transnational coordination among autocratic countries. In development finance, for example, China is really huge. And I think there is definitely some mutual aid going on among the heavily sanctioned countries, trade in arms and oil and gas, and gold and crypto, things like that are going on. But otherwise, I think the efforts among autocratic countries to resist democracy tend to be ad hoc and uncoordinated or short-lived. There are, for example, there are a couple of organizations of election observers who were basically fake election observers. There are people from autocratic countries who were sponsored and paid for by autocratic countries, and they go observe elections and certify the fairness of elections that are really not fair at all. But these are really ad hoc efforts. They don't really have a lasting impact. It's not that well coordinated. But otherwise, I think a lot of these coordination efforts among autocratic countries are not that coordinated. Many of them are ad hoc efforts or short-lived efforts. For example, there are organizations of fake election observers who are hired by and come from autocratic countries that certify as fair elections that are anything but fair. Spreading propaganda through social media has gotten a lot of attention, and I think that that's a serious concern. But it's not necessarily pushing in an undemocratic direction. And I think there's really not a common agenda between the major purveyors of fake news and other kinds of things, between Russia, North Korea, China, Iran. Instead, I think there, if there is a common goal, is basically to sow discord, to create disagreement. And I think it does have an impact of creating doubt or confusion about the truth and questioning the news and whether there are any reliable resources. But in terms of what democracies can do to deal with this, I think we already have multiple organizations that have democracy strengthening as part of their mission. And I'm thinking of the European Union, NATO, even the Organization of American States in Latin America. And while the U.S. has been uncooperative in some respects, Europeans have done a good job of seeking some unity. It's a struggle. It's difficult. There's a lot of negotiation going on and horse trading, but it's always a struggle to get countries to work together in a coordinated way.
You mentioned that the United States currently exerts a negative influence on global democratic norms. How does this erosion of U.S. democratic credibility affect incentives for leaders elsewhere who may already be testing the limits of their own institutions?
Yes, I think the United States has a big impact on other countries, whether it's a positive one or a negative one. And I think that the erosion of democracy that we're probably seeing in the United States right now gives a green light to autocrats around the world. There's very little expectation that the United States is going to make strenuous efforts to protect democracy where it's under siege right now. So I think that's a damaging thing. I've done some research that tries to quantify how much influence countries have over democracy in other countries. And the short-term changes, like coups and transitions to democracy, on average, they tend to have a significant impact. It's not a large impact, but it's a statistically significant impact, but only in the very short term. So most of the impact happens within the first year, and after 3 years, it really doesn't have any further impact on countries. But that's the average effect for average country in the world. And I think the United States is one of the superpowers, has a much larger impact on other countries. And right now it's probably having a negative impact on democratization around the world. There's a longer term impact of just how democratic a country is in a given moment. And that's a very small impact, but significant from year to year, but it does accumulate over a long period of time. So that over several decades, countries tend to become surrounded by other countries that have similar kinds of regimes just because of the example they set and whatever efforts they're making to protect democracy in their neighborhood. So I think that's one of the major reasons why we see regions of the world that are predominantly democratic or predominantly undemocratic.
You outlined several warning signs that precede deeper democratic collapse, including party system breakdown and attacks on the judiciary and media. Which of these indicators should raise the most immediate alarm for democratic domestic actors and their international partners alike?
One warning sign is a major loss of support by the largest parties in the system. When voters start to distrust the parties, lose faith that they're going to represent them effectively, that's a sign that that the system is weakening. And in many cases, especially in the last three decades, a weakening of traditional parties has created an opportunity for the emergence of anti-pluralist leaders, outsiders who haven't been active in politics before, but are irresponsible politicians who promise easy solutions to difficult problems. And so when they emerge, and especially if they win power, then we often see attacks on the media, attempts to suspend the licenses of certain broadcasters, or attacks on journalists, including murders of journalists in some cases, or pressures to get people fired or have them arrested, which can lead to self-censorship, or then more heavy-handed prior censorship by governments. We've also seen attacks on the judiciary to try to replace or fire judges, appoint loyal people, people loyal to the government, to the judiciary, or attempts to bribe or intimidate judges to win their acquiescence to things. And I think that's really, the judiciary is really a pivotal actor in this process, because if you win control of the judiciary, then anything you want to do can become legal in the eyes of the judiciary. And then it becomes harder for other people to resist. And then after these things start having these early warning signs, then you can start to see repression of opposition leaders and organizations and parties. And then one of the last things to go often is the quality of elections, either manipulating elections, manipulating the suffrage, intimidating voters during campaigns, or even, and this is less common now, but it still happens, just counting the votes in an unfair way, stealing elections, or in the worst case, suspending elections altogether. So those are not, those are no longer early warning signs. Those are signs that the process has gone too far.
Nowadays, leaders with autocratic tendencies do not always do outright repression and coups. They are also leaning towards more subtle, institutionalized forms of autocratization. Does this shift towards electoral autocracies, where a country holds elections just to portray to the world that they are democratic, but in reality, these elections are manipulated, an electoral autocracy? Do you think that this rising trend of electoral autocracies is a more sophisticated strategy for autocratic leaders, or is it a simply a different phase in the same struggle for power?
Yes, absolutely. They're becoming more sophisticated. It's become harder these days to for a regime to get away with carrying out a military seizure of executive power, or to dissolve parliament, to jail or murder opposition figures, or to suspend elections outright, which is, I think, an important reason why we're seeing more electoral autocracies. And so the techniques that autocrats use have become more subtle, pushing up against the guardrails of democracy, as Levitsky and Ziblatt call them, trying things and seeing what works. The trial and error process of pushing and seeing what you can get away with. And sometimes they go too far, too fast, and they get stopped. I think that's probably a good way to understand what happened with Bolsonaro in Brazil. But often it leads to enough concentration of power that it makes an overt repression possible.
Do you think that this rising trend of electoral autocracies are here to stay, and these regimes continue to hold elections because democracy still retains global legitimacy? A recent example of this would be India. Why do you think that this norm remains so powerful, and are they here to stay?
I think that they have become more common than they used to be, and I think they're probably going to stay as a common phenomenon in the world, but that doesn't mean that every electoral autocracy is going to remain an electoral autocracy. I think there's always a chance that opposition can win strength. Maybe a government delegitimizes itself by not managing the economy well, or going overboard and abusing rights. And that can lead to opposition and support being thrown to other parties. And given that they still feel obligated to hold elections, sometimes they can be turned out of office. It happens. At the same time, I think some electoral autocracies go farther in the other direction and eventually hold sham elections that no one thinks is really a fair election, and eventually give up the pretense and stop elections altogether. That's less and less likely, but it still happens. And I think that's the kind of world we're living in, where these things come about and they're difficult to remove. They will probably last for a while. And I think it's a model that will be available to governments for many decades. But I hope that some of these specific electoral autocracies will fail and be available for returns to democracy. Well, I would think a fundamental lesson, and we've already mentioned this, but the reason that we're seeing more electoral autocracies is that rulers don't feel like they can do away with elections. They feel obligated to hold an election. They have to pretend to be democratic. And I think that gives the opposition, the pro-democratic opposition, an opportunity. So it's beyond the pale to suspend elections. And eventually people get tired of autocrats. They're not perfect people. They have deficiencies. Sometimes they become complacent and they allow abuses to happen underneath them. Eventually everybody mismanages the economy. And so that combination of people being tired of autocrats, having a reaction to some of the failures of these regimes, combined with the continued existence of elections, creates an opportunity for opposition figures to win elections. And, you know, there are a number of cases where this has happened. I think South Korea, there was this immediate reaction when Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law. Just immediately, thousands of people mobilized and stormed parliament and demanded the end of martial law. Chile, after a long regime by Augusto Pinochet, that regime was ended by the regime losing a plebiscite and being forced to hold fair elections that led to a strong democratic government. In Poland, there was a more populist regime that was undermining democracy, but they lost elections and an opposition coalition is now in power. They're facing some struggles, but that was a return to democracy by elections. I think Ukraine, at one point, it was an electoral process with the Maidan demonstrations that allowed a more democratic regime to return. Brazil, we already mentioned. I think after the Correa regime in Ecuador, it was an election that led to one of Correa's proteges being elected, but not following in his footsteps, led to a return to democracy. In an earlier period, Slovakia had a experiment with a more populist, illiberal regime, but there was an electoral process that led to a return to democracy there. So I think this is not an uncommon process in which a country moves in a direction of autocracy, but still holds elections, and eventually they lose and more democratic leaders come about. That's not the only way that it can happen, but it's there's a logic to it. And I think there's a reason to expect that that will continue to happen in some cases.
You mentioned earlier that it can be very difficult to mobilize coordinated resistance against autocratization. What practical strategies can democratic actors, specifically opposition parties, civil society, or independent institutions, use to push back before democratic erosion becomes deeply entrenched?
One thing that's very important is that because of these subtle methods, it's difficult for a leader in isolation, an opposition leader in isolation, whether it's a politician or leader of a social movement or representative in Congress or even a law firm or a university, to stand up and resist by itself, because they'll always be outflanked. And so what really is required is for actors inside countries where this kind of backsliding is going on to join forces and to present a united front to resist things. And that could consist of mass resignations when there are people in the executive branch who disagree with government policy. It could be a matter of forming an alliance among politicians to call out and denounce actions that are taking that are weakening democracy. It could be a matter of organizing boycotts, massive demonstrations, popular action. But at any rate, not letting people be singled out and isolated so they can be easily defeated.
You stressed the importance of internal coordination and unified fronts within countries experiencing democratic backsliding. At the same time, do you see a stronger role for transnational democratic coordination, or should existing institutions like the EU and NATO simply act more decisively?
I'm not sure a new organization is needed. It takes a while for organizations to form and really be active, but I do think that the existing organizations that we have need to do a better job of calling out attacks on democracy when they happen, recognizing what's going on, and not falling for the disguise of just holding elections, because I think we should know by now that merely holding elections is not enough. There's more to democracy than that. Democracy requires more than just holding elections and even holding elections where the votes are counted accurately. There's a whole long process that goes on leading up to elections in which it's important to allow parties to campaign without interference and intimidation. It's important for the media to be able to broadcast the news and to be able to carry out investigations and report on it without fear of persecution. It's important for civil society organizations to be able to organize, to gather information and publicize it, to organize protests. It's important for media organizations to be able to publicize things fairly and accurately without fear of intimidation. So there are many parts of the democratic process that all have to be respected for an election to really be meaningful.
We've come to the last question of this podcast. We are living in a time where there is a historic rise in autocratization around the world. Do you think democracy can be saved? And what gives you hope about the struggle ahead?
Well, I don't pretend that democratic mobilization is a surefire cure for authoritarianism around the world. Sometimes social movements just get repressed and lose strength. It's very disheartening to see, for example, what's happened to Venezuela. There have been many, many massive protests against the Chavez and Maduro regime, but they failed. And it's been a really sad situation. Nevertheless, there have also been instances in which massive popular protests for democracy have had some success in the Philippines and Ukraine, the color revolutions in Eastern Europe, at least for a while. They lasted in promoting democracy. I think India could be counted as a case of that earlier in its history. So there are some reasons why massive protests, if they're peaceful, can produce a return to democracy. But being peaceful is really essential. The research on this is makes it very clear that violent protests don't do anything to promote democracy, but nonviolent protests do some of the time. And I think it's exactly for the reasons that Gandhi taught and that Martin Luther King Jr. taught, that if you lead a nonviolent protest, you can win the sympathies of the larger population, and other actors care about the sympathies of the larger population. and especially if they see nonviolent, innocent protesters being hurt and treated unfairly, that wins even more sympathy. But the moment opposition protests become violent, then they start to look like hooligans or people who are irresponsible members of society, and other people don't support them. Well, because there have been so many countries around the world where democracy has been suffering and has failed in some cases, some very important cases. And I think this could snowball. It's possible that if we don't find ways to resist this trend, then it could keep going further. But really, I've always said that democracy promotion begins at home. The most effective way to prevent democracy from failing in other countries is to bolster democracy in your own country. And I think that's especially true for the United States right now. I don't want the United States to keep sending signals that give a green light to dictators around the world. And I want the United States to return to being a champion of democracy. But that's going to take a big effort here.
Thank you, Professor Kopich, for joining us and for this thoughtful discussion on democracy. I am Kritika Narayanan, and this is the Small World Big Problems podcast. Thank you for listening.